Check 1, 2, 3.
Checking a microphone.
Checking out things.
All right, this is not awkward at all.
Not at all.
Not at all. It's not weird at all.
No, it's not weird.
All right, so we're, my name is Christian with the Most High Show, and today we are talking about the social aspects of addiction and drug use, and with me is Mitchell.
My name is Mitchell.
It's pronounced with the itchel. And so we're trying to do this podcast version. We usually do a video. We're trying to do something different here by producing just the audio version. Really, why is because I listened to one of the podcasts driving. I was like, man, there's like a lot of stuff going on in the background. And because it was a video, and I just put out the audio, put it on as a podcast. So that was kind of like, oh, maybe we should take some time and produce an actual audio version. And so this is our inaugural. Is that the right word?
Inaugural. We're keeping it clean.
It's our first jump at it. Social aspects of addiction. So I'm a drug addict, or was, or am. Struggle with that. Can't use drugs. Can't drink beer. My drug addiction was bad enough that I had to pay somebody to fix me because I couldn't do it on my own. So I had to leave for a while. I didn't pay for it. The company I worked with did, which is amazing. So recently I went and spoke at a high school, Milton High School. And shared my experience and how I got into drugs and alcohol, and I hadn't really really thought about that deeply. And as I was there and kind of explaining, my first times using and this and that, I've always kind of like focused on the latter part of my addiction and what led me to that rehab and all that. But when I was sharing at the high school, it reminded me of so much why I began to use drugs, which really kind of made me start thinking about this. And as I started doing research, I started finding there's a lot of other thought around the social aspect to drug use and drug addiction and the rituals that kind of go with drug addiction and drug use. And so when I thought back to my own experience, I remember, growing up in Bakersfield, we had we called it tag banging. We weren't much bangers, but we were, taggers. So we hit the streets and paint, and so it was a little crew we had. And that connection of us all together was pretty special. Even though we did a lot of messed up stuff while we were together.
The camaraderie,
the brotherhood, the deep connection that was there. And so with that kind of lifestyle we started using drugs. So drugs was like, it was ancillary, is that the right word? It was like on the side, it was garnish. It wasn't the main dish. The main dish was us getting together and doing wild stuff. And the drugs were just kind of like on the side. But it was a part of that whole process,
Changing the way you feel.
Changing the way I felt, yeah. And changing the way I felt was fun. And it was adventurous, and I was with people that I loved and appreciated and had this deep connection with. And so in retrospect, kind of looking at how the social aspects, how easily it is to kind of fall into that, especially in high school, I think towards the latter end of my addiction, I was medicating. The drugs was medication. It was to escape the pain. Probably the drugs had caused a vicious cycle. But in the beginning, there was this social aspect. And I think some of the things that, one of the reasons why I felt like this topic is a good topic to talk about is because I think that there's a sense of belonging and loneliness that kind of we all experience. And sometimes, we can get into these situations where we find that, but it's not in the most healthy way. Can you take me back to like when you first, like, and what was the social kind of chemistry there.
Yeah. So what immediately came to my mind is it was very fun to do bad things. That was the kind of kid I was.
Yeah.
So
it's adventurous, rebellious, exciting.
I remember committing my first felony in third grade.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably not normal.
Right.
And it made sense to me that I would take this Ace Ventura.
What was your felony? You getting
I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
So my first felony when I was in third grade, I had Ace Ventura and I got it from Blockbuster. So
you had rented it.
Yeah.
For everybody who's listening, Blockbuster used to be a store where you'd actually have to go into to rent movies.
Yeah. Getting old here. But apparently my mom rented it for me. I don't think I was old enough to have a Blockbuster membership card or a job. And it occurred to me, you know, I'm opportunistic. And it occurred to me that we had a setup in my home that my stepfather used to duplicate VHS. And I knew from watching the beginning of the videos that there was this warning that if you were to make copies and distribute them, that it was highly illegal.
Right.
That wasn't enough to deter me. I was actually kind of excited by the proposition of doing something I shouldn't be doing.
The warning probably helped inspire you to do it.
And the motivation of financial gain, because even at the third grade level, living in near poverty, I saw this as a way to get things that I didn't have access to. So I started selling them.
Was your stepfather, he was like the godfather of your enterprise?
Well, he didn't know.
Oh.
He was doing it legitimately. He was just making copies of videos for his friends. This is back when that technology was kind of new.
Yeah.
So I took it to school and started selling it.
Yeah.
So that was my first felony. So some people might say I was predispositioned to do bad things.
Right.
And predispositioned to challenge authority and challenge rules.
Right.
So that's something that was innate within me. So fast forward a bit to late middle school, early high school, trying to fit in, kind of the new kid, the youngest kids on the block as freshmen. Really, I was primed to look for my route. And I wasn't in this group of popular kids. I didn't grow up with these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so at a certain point, I saw people doing drugs. And for a while, I knew that was something that was not ideal. And I actually was scared. But as you start to see the people that you want to interact with, pretty girls,
mm-hmm.
doing drugs,
mm-hmm.
for me, it wasn't too hard to make the connection that to fit in, that's what you did.
Right.
And that's something that you could talk to them about. And that was a way that people basically met to spend time together. So pretty quickly started smoking weed with my friends and found out it was easier to enjoy the social situation without as much anxiety.
Right.
So I would imagine I got hooked to the ease and comfort that comes with taking that one and spending time in social situations. So looking back, I probably had some anxiety.
Yeah.
Probably had some insecurities, mm-hmm. some fears, and this made me feel like I could breathe, like I was okay. And I was able to laugh in a way that I don't know that I had ever really been able to laugh.
Right. And when everyone else is laughing too, right? So you guys are having a shared experience.
Right.
Right.
So for me, it was meaningful.
Yeah.
There was something almost magical about it.
Right. The drugs kind of enhanced or played a part into whatever was happening relationally in that situation, right?
Well, it basically opened the door to a social life that I had always wanted and never had.
Yeah.
So, and there's that camaraderie and there's that shared, we're sharing a secret here, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so now we're part of something and we look out for each other. And so relationships built. And I do remember fast forwarding to college that it hit me at a certain point that, yes, what I'm doing is destructive. It's not ideal. I'm mm-hmm. risking it all.
Mm-hmm.
But the most beautiful women, the most amazing social situations that I could imagine at that time were deeply intertwined in the drug culture.
Right. Yeah.
I wanted to date sorority girls. Sorority girls liked drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So being a drug dealer put me in an elevated position, and it made for a status that they were attracted to.
Right.
And it also gave me the financial means that I didn't come to school with, like a lot of the kids. I didn't go to a fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
My parents weren't going to pay for that. So it put me almost in an elevated position where, you know, I'm selling drugs to these people and they look up to me and they respect me. And along with that came what felt like money, power, and respect.
Right.
So for me, that was very addictive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my final point on that is, even though I knew the risks were great, I thought that when I had a kid, I would have gotten what I wanted, the social situation, the marriage, whatever.
Right.
And then I would put it down.
Right. So at that point, it had already, drugs do what drugs do, right?
And some people are definitely more quickly killing themselves and knowing that. Yeah. My goal was never to take it to the end. My goal was to pull the emergency hatch.
Yeah.
And parachute out of there.
Yeah, right.
So.
Yeah.
That's my experience with that.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting because I think like, you know, I can remember part of selling drugs in high school. And yeah, I wasn't a very good drug dealer because I did a lot of my own drugs. I just was selling it to be able to have it regularly. But I do remember in looking back at that time that there was that connection. There was that, this sense of importance, the sense of being seen and being known, which I think is a fundamental kind of, desire for all of us as just humans living on earth, is this desire to be seen and known. And so I guess part of the thinking behind, really starting to focus on the social aspects of addiction, right? Because we have a pretty good understanding, and there's more to be known about the physiological things that happen in our brains and the brain chemistry and how it changes and how we become addicted and how our body requires it and all that kind of stuff. But there's been more discussion around the social aspect of it, with some thought of like, if are we creating kind of situations that help incubate this kind of lifestyle or behavior, right? And high school is like the best breeding ground to make you feel alone as possible. And I'm sure everyone's experience is different when it comes to drugs, right? But I've found in most of the conversations that I have with people that there's a social thing happening there. It's not like you go buy a bag of weed your first time from the dope man and go sit alone in the fields and smoke weed.
Right.
And trip out. I mean, I'm sure somebody has that experience. But in most cases, there's a group aspect to it. And so the idea of like, at that age in high school, can somebody really truly feel like they can be themselves and they belong? And if they can we as a society create that kind of environment? Is that possible? Now, you've done some work with kids and, you know.
That's an interesting question. So I think about the kids who were very much into sports.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a correlation with the amount of time spent in those social circles where sports were at the forefront, and a less amount of drug addiction.
Right. So so you brought that up. So I played football for most of my high school, and we lost every game. The years I played, 3 years, we lost every game. No lie. Every single game. And the same group of guys always showed up every year. 2 days in August and, you know, fighting through the season, and we just kept losing. And I started really, you know, when I started doing meth was when drugs started taking over my life. And that happened around the end of sophomore, junior year. And so by junior year, I quit football like mid-season. And they ended up tying like 2 weeks later. It's like It's like a freaking storybook, you know? It's like I quit and then they tie, you know? It's like I didn't hold out to that end. But there is a lot. As soon as I quit, man, my drug use and my criminal activity and my lifestyle just completely got very out of control because I had more time on my hands to do those things, right? And then the other thing is in sports, you do have, there is a sense of, you know, you got to be healthy. And so it's like, you know, maybe smoking weed or whatever and getting high and putting crazy chemicals in your body might not be the best thing. So sports is one way, right? That's a good idea, you know?
I had this same story almost.
Yeah?
Except we didn't lose all the time. I had this friend that I used to smoke weed with, and I was very involved in crew. So we would...
What's that? What's crew?
Rowing.
Oh.
Yeah. So I was on the rowing team.
Nice.
And everything was going great. But I had started...
Rowing along. Everything's cool.
Doing great in school. Oh, okay. Rowing, winning state championships. But that was around the time I started realizing that there was this social aspect with women and drugs. And so I was becoming more open to it. Plus, I like to do bad things. So there was a tipping point where my friend told me he could pick me up from crew practice and we could get high. Well, he showed up early and pulled a stunt and said our mom was in the hospital. Which is terrible.
Wow.
And we don't have the same mom.
That's bold.
So he acted like he was my brother and got me out of a crew practice. And it just felt so amazing to get out of something so challenging and go do something that I consider to be the most fun.
Right.
And party. And that was the end of my crew career.
Oh, wow. Oh, he's here. He's sitting in the room with us.
Yeah. The gentleman is actually still my good friend.
The culprit.
And he's
alive.
Alive and sober, and we're working through recovery together.
That's amazing. That's a good win for that. That's funny. Because he's looking over to his left. So shout out to Drew. He's in the building.
Thanks for picking me up from crew practice, Drew.
Yeah, and thanks for picking him up and bringing him here today.
Yep.
That's pretty, what'd you say? Serendipitous.
Serendipitous, that's right.
Yeah, so in our research, we looked around, and because neither of us are really that smart.
You picked up on that?
So we needed to get some fuel for this fire, you know, because there are people who are way smarter than us. And so I found some things on loneliness, which I thought was really interesting. There was a stat that basically being lonely for prolonged periods of time can actually shorten your life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Think of an extreme example, solitary confinement.
Yeah. Yeah, we interviewed a guy who spent 10 years in the SHU in California. He got arrested in the 70s, and so he spent a lot of time in there. It's amazing that he made it out. So part of the idea too behind like the reason why we do this show and the reason why the Most High show exists is because for those people who are out there on the interwebs listening or watching, there's great power in the power saying me too, right? Saying I've experienced this, I've went through this, and someone's hearing your story hopefully and is going, yeah, me too, that makes sense. I did do that, and that was kind of it. And I think that's why the recovery community is so important for us post, you know, drug use when we're in recovery, that we maintain some sort of authentic community.
Absolutely.
Right? Because it keeps us from kind of falling back into that pitfalls, right? And so that's where, you know, there's a lot to be said about the way that rooms exist, the way the recovery rooms exist, that, you know, there's very little required for you to be in, you know. Recently I've been thinking a lot about tribal kind of living, right? We live in tribes, right? Religions become tribes and churches become tribes and then tribes. And, And so the recovery community becomes a tribe, right? But it's just got this very low bar of entry. And in that is this, allows it to be something very great to us. Because, not to say that it gives me license to use, but if I were to, that there's this constant body of people who would be there. They wouldn't shun me. I mean, it may be awkward, but, there is this sense of willingness to stop using is really the only desire, right?
Basically.
Yeah. And so we have a great community in recovery that's, to me, I think is essential. And when people do relapse, who maybe a couple of different things happen, but one aspect is like maybe you're in meetings, you're showing up, but there's something brewing inside of you. You asked me the question in my kitchen, how are you doing? Well, I give you the answer, right? Well, and so, but it's really easy. I could really easily take that, my answer to you, and just keep it inside, deal with it, and not give that answer. So I'm not really actually being an authentic community with others if I'm doing that, right? And so that can easily lead me back to the thinking that can get me to use again.
I always heard secrets keep us sick.
Yeah.
And for me, if I don't tell somebody how I'm feeling,
yeah,
especially when it's something that's not pleasant,
mm-hmm.
is a secret, because
yeah,
that will have the potential to snowball. And I've learned that I've got to deal with things as they come, because if I shove it all down deep inside, eventually it explodes.
Yeah.
Oftentimes at the most inopportune time.
Right.
So I'm
It might not be relapse, it might just be being a complete dick or something.
That is right. Really something that I struggle with.
Yeah, right. I think we all have that. Yeah.
So I was thinking about what you put up here
mm-hmm.
on our outline. It says the opposite of addiction is connection.
Yeah.
And that made me smile.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people think the opposite of addiction.
Sobriety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this is a very dynamic way of life that, like you reference, I'm not that smart. I'm not going to be able to figure that out. And luckily there was a community willing to embrace me. And I was just thinking about it. I had to let go of not just friends, not just a fiance, not just a way of life, not even just my brothers. I had to let go of my best friends in the form of substances.
Yeah.
The things that, if I had nothing else in life, made me feel okay.
Right. You do I used to do this when I had pills. I'd put them in my jean pocket. I'd put them in the little, you know, the little small pocket in the Levi's. And I'd put my pills there. And I'd always just kind of put my hand down there and just feel that I had them there. This is like a little, oh.
You knew you were going to be okay
until
they ran out.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing is, I think I could have gone to treatment. I think I could have learned everything there was to learn, but without putting in the work to integrate myself into the appropriate community and putting in the effort to build those relationships and eventually take what I've learned and been successful with
mm-hmm.
and communicate that in helpful ways to others and help other people do the same.
Right.
I don't think I would have made it to, you know, year five. I don't think I would have made it to year two.
Right. Yeah.
So the amazing thing is the community I left behind, some of them have reached out and I've been able to help them. And some of them are no longer with us and pretty much everything in between. But what I found is a fellowship of people who are amazing that I never knew I wanted in my life.
Yeah, right.
I never knew I wanted to be completely open with someone about my deepest, darkest moments.
Right, yeah.
You couldn't have convinced me of that.
Right.
So, you know, I wasn't going to snitch on myself.
Right.
That was stuff that you take to the grave.
Yeah.
And so there was freedom and sharing those things.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize I was carrying them around and they were heavy.
Yeah.
And so I no longer am haunted by things that I used to ruminate right. on, which means think about them over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get past them. So some people go to therapy, and yeah. I think therapy is great.
Yeah, it is.
I've spent a lot of time with therapists, but at the end of the day, working with another addict or alcoholic has been the greatest gift.
Yeah.
Because it's allowed for me to let go, and it's allowed for me to share how I did that, and I've seen other people recover.
Yeah.
And that's what really has kind of sandwiched me into this lifestyle. It was one thing to give up the drugs and alcohol. It was another thing to work on the program that kept me sober. But to give it back is almost like I'm linked in this very powerful chain on both ends.
Yeah.
And I'm not going anywhere so long as I keep my hand stretched out to the new guy and I keep working with the OGs, you know,
right.
the people who have been yeah, doing yeah. this and people Absolutely. Are practicing good orderly direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, you know, what's better than that?
Yeah. There's two things that I was thinking is that when I got a year, my first year, I was driving to work, and I used to go to work really early in the morning, 5 a.m. I was working at the Steve Harvey Morning Show. And so this was the company that sent me to rehab, right? So they were very supportive, amazing company, amazing place. And so I'm on my way to work. I hit my years, my year, right? It's a huge moment for me. And I just start thinking about all these people that God has placed in my life, right? And that was the thought I had. Wow, it's this guy, this person, wow, this. And the company itself are the people there that supported me through this year. It was a pretty crappy year, you know what I mean? It was rough. It was a lot of wins, but there was a lot of weirdness too, right? I'm changing into a new human. And so I start bawling. I mean, uncontrollably. So I'm driving to work. I'm bawling. It's like the real cry, like where snot's coming, you know, like, oh, it's good. It was really
primal.
It was freeing. It was like, oh, and I was accepting, and with great gratitude, this grace that had been given to me, right? To be a year clean. Well, I get to pull up to the office and my eyes are bloodshot red, which is like to come inside of like, all right, I got to find the safest person I could find and ask him for Visine. Which then I had to explain why I was asking for Visine. But I thought that was pretty...
That's a weird place to be in as a newly ironic. Sober individual.
Yeah. It was great. But yeah, it was that first year, those people that I had that really helped me to get through. The other thing is being in community. That one of the things that we, when we were searching around, is emotional, first aid.
Emotional first aid. I've never heard that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Emotionally.
Was that on here?
Yeah. It's all right. Emotional first aid, right? So like, you know, like when you have a headache, you take an aspirin, right? If you break your foot, you don't just walk it off and be like, oh,
I remember that. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Like you know, we actually have to take care of these when we physically are hurting. We go through any length we have to go through to deal with that pain. Right. And if you have a headache and you take an aspirin and it doesn't work, then maybe it's a sinus thing. So you take an allergy. Right. But we don't just let it go. And so this is the same thing about with emotional kind of first aid and emotional upkeep, spiritual inventory. Right. Moral inventory. These things help us to continually kind of check through. And one of the things that it said on there was, and we can share, I'll share the links. It'll be on the website, The Most High Show. You'll be able to go find out all this information, themosthighshow.com. But one of the things that it said, you know, is that, if we don't take care, we don't take care of these things. We don't acknowledge it, right? We have to acknowledge that I'm feeling depressed. What's that feeling? Well, that's depression. That's hopelessness. That's anxiety. These are human emotions. We're going to feel these things. And first step is to acknowledge that we got it. That's happening. And the second step is to you know, confess it or share it or, you know, let it out to a community of like-minded people, right? So that we can continue to I guess, be the best versions of ourselves, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's one of the great things that happens in the recovery community. So I'm not sure if we've covered everything here. I did have some stats I wanted to pull up just to kind of like put some of this into numbers for people who like numbers. I like numbers when they help make my point. All right, anxiety disorders, all right? They affect 40 million adults in the United States alone, 18 years older. That's 18% of the population.
And it could be higher.
And that's just, yeah, that's just the stats. So this is from the ADAA.org. I think it's the American Drug Addiction Association. What is it? Let me kind of tell you what it is. ADAA. Oh, Anxiety and Depression Association of America. Get it right. So, yeah, that's a huge percentage of people, right? With some form of anxiety disorder. That's existing out there. So it's no wonder why, you know, drugs is an easy solution to help us get rid of that, right?
And it seems like with the growing population, resources are becoming more scarce. We work more as a society than we've ever worked. Yeah. We're expected to go to school longer. You know, trying to keep up with everything that we've got going on.
Yeah.
From our phones to our jobs, to our significant others, to our kids, to our families, having a hobby, staying sober.
Yeah.
Maintaining our vehicles.
The future, the past, the here, the
now. Our health. Yeah. Going, working out.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, just a quick point about one of the things that was on our agenda. We said something about spiritual fitness.
Yeah.
And a guy made an interesting point to me, a guy that was one of the people I attribute to helping save my life. I worked with him intensely for about a year on moral inventories and spiritual fitness. And he said to me, working out is an interesting parallel as far as physical fitness to spiritual fitness. And he said, whether you believe it or not, if you go to the gym and work out, you're going to get stronger.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was a non-believer, and he said, spiritual fitness is kind of like that.
Right.
If you pray, and you meditate, and you do the right thing.
Right.
And you work on things that have been identified as positive spiritual goals, whether you believe it or not, it'll work.
Yeah.
And I took that challenge.
Yeah.
And I no longer consider myself to be a non-believer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this says that 36% of those suffering from anxiety disorders actually seek treatment. So it's a large group of people out there who are self-medicating, right?
Dying. Look at the rate of people overdosing.
40 million adults, that's 18% of the population, is dealing with anxiety disorders. Now, this is for adults, and, you know, we talked about our kind of first foyers into drug use. But I wonder if, like, the idea to say, like, you can't come to work and go, you know, I'm just tired. Like, I'm really tired. And I need a day to, like, just sleep it off or just rest.
You know? Some companies are getting better, and they've got departments. Can't remember the name of them.
HR departments?
But within HR, there is a name that's escaping me, where if you've got a serious issue going on, you can go speak to that department, and probably the same department that you worked with to get treatment.
Right. Well, they didn't have departments, but
unofficial department.
The departments was Steve's barber. That was the department.
Okay.
But But no, exactly. So, and this goes back to what we talked about with the physical ailments, right? Like if I broke my arm, I don't need to prove this case. I just say, look, I broke my arm. I can't come into work today. Or I have the flu. Or a great one. I have diarrhea, right? That's like the best one. If you're
I've actually used that and it wasn't true.
Who has? You have. Oh. So disappointed.
It works.
It's a good one because no one wants you in the office if you got diarrhea.
No. Nobody wants that problem.
No one wants that. So, but again, that's a physical ailment, and that'll be quickly. Everyone's going to say, yeah, take a day, man. Get some Pepto-Bismol, sleep it off, stay close to the bathroom. But when we say, I'm not dealing well with life, right? Something's, my chest is raising up, there's too many thoughts in my head. No one's going to go, oh man, maybe you're dealing with some anxiety and we need to deal with that healthy way, right? So what I'm saying is part of the reason why I think drugs and the social aspect of drug addiction comes, they interplay so well is that we're not allowed to not be okay. You know, and I'm a Christian, and so I'm very critical of the church, but I'm a Christian, so I feel like I'm in the club, so I can do that. And but I feel like that's not a sense I get when I go to my local bodies of believers. The sense that I can come in and go, hey, I'm not really sure about all this Jesus stuff. You know, like I mean, are we really? You know, I mean, is that okay? I don't know. I don't think that you can walk into some of these places and say, hey, I'm struggling and have an authentic, caring response back like you would if you came in and said, oh, I physically am hurt.
Right.
Right.
So the name came to me. I think they're employee assistance programs,
mm-hmm.
but basically some progressive companies are setting up specific departments where if you're having an issue,
yeah,
substance abuse,
yeah,
marital problems, something
right
going on that's affecting you up here, you can go get the help you need. People are starting to come around. But I, as far as the church goes, I haven't spent much time in church since I was younger. And it's something that I'm looking into doing more of.
Yeah.
And this is one way that
yeah
I'm connecting with.
Yeah, sitting across the table from
my roots. So I don't have the answer to that, but I would hope, or I'd imagine that some more progressive churches,
yeah,
would be more willing to have that conversation.
I think that's the ideal, right? I mean, the ideal is that, you know, and I think there's a lot of people studying what's happening in the recovery community because it's freaking working, right? I mean, a lot of us are recovering, and so there's a lot to be learned from how accepting the what can be learned and extrapolated from the steps, which, so without diving too far, going too far, but I just wanted to say that, you know, I think that that's like it's a big deal that I think you see why it's such a high percentage of the population, because a lot of those, that 40 million, I guarantee you a lot of them are going to church and maybe not feeling like they can, bring that up, you know, and who's to blame on that? You know, like I can't really point the finger at that, right? It's probably a little bit on both sides there, but I would like to see the church, ideally, right? Idealistically, that's what the church is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a place where you can show up. And that's might be why.
I think we, as a progressive community or progressing community, as leaders, we can hopefully change the conversation and be more proactive.
Yeah.
I can't say for sure, but maybe if someone would have reached out to me and said, hey, you know, if you're ever struggling with this, you may or may not know there's help, but it actually works.
Yeah.
I don't know if that would have helped, but I can imagine that perhaps that could be helpful for other people. And I feel like I'll be in a position to let people know not only is there help, but it works.
Yeah.
And it saved my life.
Yeah.
Might be able to save yours too.
That's right. All right. So, We have the mosthighshow.com that you can go to get more information on this kind of stuff. You can message us on Facebook /mosthighshow or send us a message on themosthighshow.com. I think there's like a button there. I'm looking for the phone number because I have a phone number that if you're listening and you want to holler at your boys and talk about this. Yeah, it's 657-464-7159. You can text or call that. Text is probably better at first. I'm not sure. No. You can call that number.
That would be awesome if someone reached out to us.
That would be great.
Just one person?
Fantastic.
That would make my week.
Yeah, but because that's really the heart of what we're trying to... I mean, you know, however well we're doing it is up to be interpreted. But the reality is that we want you to know that you're not alone and that no matter what it is that you're going through, that you can reach out. And there's females that you can talk to. So if you're a female and you feel like talking to another female, that's cool too. So the number is 657-464-7159.